3, 2, 1. Download the future.
Hello and welcome to TGS Replay. The gamer scene is part of the Unified Gamers Network.
The Unified Gamers Network.
Big Red Potion.
Gamer.uk. Ninja Fat Pigeon.
Frugal Game and Scrooge Cast.
TheGamerScene.com.
Spotify's podcast around the UK.
UGN offers a little something for everyone, from the serious analysis of Big Red Potion to the fun but well-informed Gamer.uk. Frugal Gaming will bring you gaming bargains to help keep your hobby alive, whilst Ninja Fat Pigeons offers one of the best and friendliest communities on the internet. And if you're one of us mature gamers, find like-minded comment with
TheGamerScene.com.
www.unifiedgamersnetwork.com.
I'm Zan Tyriad, better known as Zan. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this special edition of Replay for the launch of the Gamer Scene. In this edition, we're going to be looking back at the 8-bit video game era, a time of Jet Set Willys, Paradroids, and Italian Plumbers. Also the time of the really first format war, particularly in the UK, between the Spectrum, the Commodore 64, and the BBC Model B. We're going to kick off this show with a quick introduction to our guests, and to give you a taste of where they're coming from, we're going to find out some of their console and computer history. So it's my pleasure, first of all, to welcome from the Gamer Scene, our forum moderator and occasional podcaster, it's Strident. Welcome, Strident.
Hi there, Zan.
And secondly, it's my pleasure to welcome a guest from Gamerdork UK. He's got impressive encyclopedic knowledge. it's Ratso. Welcome, Ratso.
Hi, don't build me up too much.
So let's start off with yourself then, Strident. So first question really is just give us a rundown of the consoles and the computers that you've owned over the years, starting with those famous 8-bit machines.
Oh yeah, well I mean I would class myself as up until recently as being a very much a home computer gamer. I think in our house when we were younger we worshipped at the egg-headed altar of Sir Clive Sinclair. I think our first home computer was a ZX81, which was a lovely machine. It had what I would tactfully describe as a streamlined memory unit in it, which was 1K, and a revolutionary touch sensitive keyboard. I think it's revolutionary, like the King of France was. He was never seen after the revolution, but the keyboard on the ZX81 was particularly horrible. We moved on to a rubber keyed ZX Spectrum 48K, which is design classic and all that, and I think our last Spectrum was a Spectrum Plus 3, which was made by Sir Alan Sugar at Amstrad, and he replaced the dodgy tape drive of the Spectrum Plus 2 with a disk drive, which due to Amstrad's strange internal things, they managed to misspell, so it was a disk with a C. And it was a strange 3-inch discs, wherever everyone else was using 3.5-inch discs, but a really decent machine. And then my last 8-bit machine was a Sam Coupe.
Wow.
Which is like, while everybody else was being really sensible and buying Atari STs and Amigas, I bought a Sam Coupe, which was like a beefed-up Spectrum, released in 1989, so it just shows, I really should have moved on by that point. It had really beefed up graphics, much better than the Spectrum. Room for two internal disk drives, 512K memory, lots of ports on the back. It was a really nice machine, but obviously nobody wanted it because everybody else was playing on their Amigas and SDs. So just been a computer, a home computer gamer, did that at uni, was into like the online gaming MUDs and MUSHes, very, very early online gaming, and only recently got into consoles with the PS2 and the Xbox and 360 and things like the Game Boy. So I'm quite late to this console scene.
Okay, thanks very much. I'm dead impressed with the Sam Coupe. I remember that coming out and being very excited about it, but then it didn't take off, did it, unfortunately?
It didn't. It was a really, really nice machine. I used to use it an awful lot.
I think they are, if you look in sort of retro magazines or if you look on some of the retro stores on the internet, they go for a tidy sum, the coupes. They're pretty rare.
Yeah, I think my sister sold mine down the car boot sale for probably about £2 or something.
God,
so
that breaks my heart.
I know. It's that along with my Millennium Falcon, which I've you know, you see for like 25 quid now. I really should have kept hold of certain things.
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible. Okay, thank you. Ratso, do you want to give us a rundown, starting with your earliest?
My earliest was a Grandstand Astro Wars LCD, which was a kind of handheld cross between Moon Crester and Galaxian. And then as soon as I got a paper round, I don't know why, but even though my friends all had Spectrums and Commodore 64s and even Amstrad CPC 464s, the one that took my I took a fancy to in my mum's catalogue was the Atari 800XL. I was not aware of the concept of third-party software support at this stage, so I didn't really know that this didn't have nearly as many games. It was a bigger deal in America, and it had lots of the sort of the big Commodore 64 releases that came out over here didn't make it over here, but were out in America, particularly on disc. And I could only afford the cassette version. And another big problem with the Atari 800XL, although it was in many ways a very capable machine, which is something I'll talk about when I talk about my first game, the cassette loading times were astonishing, and there was no facility for turbo load at all. So I did spend most of the next 5 years waiting for games to load, and often them breaking down at the very last minute.
Resetting the tape counter. Yeah.
Yeah, horrendous business, especially multi-load games, which came along later. So you'd be waiting 20 minutes for the first section to load, and then even multi-load bits would be sort of 4 or 5 minutes a time. So unbelievable, really. And luckily, it did also have a cartridge slot, so that was nice, just to be able to shove in Robotron or Joust or something occasionally and get the cassette out of the way. But then I moved on to Amiga 500. Same year I got a Mega Drive, a few years later a SNES, then I got an Amiga 1200 with a hard disk drive. That was the future. Then I leapt straight to the PS1. Got a Game Boy Pocket after that, soon after a Saturn. This was when my gaming passion really kicked in the mid-90s, when I could start to afford things for myself. I got an N64, then a Dreamcast. Then the next gen, I got all three, the PS2, the GameCube, and the Xbox. Then I got a GBA SP, the clamshell one, the first clamshell one. I got another PC at some stage along the way. Then a DS, then a PSP, then a DS Lite. This gen, I've got the 360, the Wii, and the PS3. I also quite recently got a GBA Micro, and this year I got a DSi, so I'm fully consoled up.
Brilliant. I actually, the Game Boy Micro, I would actually say it's probably one of my favourite pieces of kit that I own. I love that device. Yeah,
it is lovely.
It didn't sell too well, but it's a fantastic little bit of kit. Yeah.
It's the only truly pockety portable game system, isn't it?
It really fits in the coin pocket. It's so small. It's brilliant. Yeah, I still use it to this day, actually. I think the charger's tickling my feet as I speak. Okay, thank you, Ratso. For myself, I actually started out Christmas 1982. I was given a Spectrum 48K, and that was my first and my most loved computer that I've ever owned, and I actually held on to that, I think, for nearly 10 years before I was foolish enough to sell it. Along with that, I kind of went through the usual iterations. So I went up to a 128 plus 2 with a dodgy tape drive. But it was still better than lots of leads and dodgy cassette players that I had to use on the original 48K. I had a BBC B, which used to do some programming on. It's, you know, where I started my career, I suppose, as a software engineer. I progressed from the Spectrum onto the Amiga 500. My first Amiga actually died a horrible death, where the Gary chip, which is, if people who know me will be appropriate, because that's my name, the Gary chip actually packed up, and that's the chip that controls the mouse and the some of the graphics. And I used to have to pick it up and slam it on the desk to get the Amiga to work, so it used to be quite amusing. I then bought an Amiga 500 Plus, and I broke that when I spilled a pot noodle in the power pack. So, and it blew up. And at that point, I got another one, and that was sold at uni. And it wasn't until much later that I actually, in fact, 5 years ago, I bought a Amiga 600 when I saw it going cheap on eBay. So I've still got an Amiga, and I still use it actually now. I've got it sort of modded with a hard drive in it. Usual sort of thing. I also went through the Game Boy route, so Game Boy, Game Boy Color, up to the Game Boy Advance, the SP, and the aforementioned Micro, which I still think is fantastic. I then kind of had a sabbatical where I really got into PC gaming, and I kind of missed out on the SNES Mega Drive era. And then I eventually got sick of PC gaming. I think, again, probably around about the same time as you, Rat, so my gaming passion was ignited when I bought an N64. I think it was probably an age thing, actually, because I think I was 23 at the time when I bought that, and I think I'd just left university, and I think I kind of got all that out of my system. It's like, right, okay, I'm going to play games again now. And then from that, on the N64, I progressed onto PS1, Dreamcast, PS2, and then I started going back and actually getting into retro games, and that's when I went back and re-bought a Spectrum, bought a SNES and a Mega Drive, bought a load of loads and loads of games on eBay. I must have spent a fortune actually on sort of buying up all the classic games on those platforms. And then from there I've bought everything that's come out, really. So PS2, GameCube, Xbox, DS, DSi, Xbox 360, PS3, Wii. I think you'll probably agree, Ratso, but my view is that if you're a mad collector like I am, you know, you have to really own every console because you like to be able to pick the best of breed from each one.
Yeah, I do agree. I must admit, over the years, because I've still not owned my own property, I've still ended up moving around for one real life reason and another. I have had to shed a certain amount of my collection of magazines and consoles and things like that, which is heartbreaking, but simply it was just getting impossible to move everything every time. So my collection isn't what it will be when I've finally properly settled down in a place of my own and can actually rebuild it up with a lot of the stuff that I've lost along the way. But certainly, as I recently argued for the Wii, as a true gamer, I think you kind of have to have at least access, even if it's a friend or something, you have to be able to play all the AAA stuff from every format.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question was asked actually on a forum a little while ago, and I can remember it being quite painful when I owned an N64 and I kind of refused to buy a PlayStation, mainly because I couldn't afford it. And I used to look on in jealousy, you know, real jealousy at things like Tekken and Gran Turismo, and I'd end up buying things like what's it called?
That bad fighting game, Fighter's Destiny.
Fighter's Destiny, yeah. And I actually quite like Fighter's Destiny, but you could just basically win with just two moves. And things like, I think it's called GT Auto. Or Auto 64, I think it may have been called in the UK. Which again was like a GT rip-off, but terrible. And I realised then that really, your best approach is just to shell out and pick best of breed. But
if you can, I couldn't agree more.
If you can, exactly. I mean, it's costly. I mean, I was quite lucky because I picked up the PlayStation 1 right towards just before the PS1 came out, you know, the funny little white thing. So I got that really cheap. I think I only paid like 80 quid for it or something. So, and then, as you do, you go back and rebuy all the classics, don't you? So
it's great. It's actually a great fun thing to do, that. Go back and get an old console really cheap. Get a, you know, you can pick up now a nice reconditioned Dreamcast for not too crazy amounts of money and have such a good time collecting all the back catalogue of brilliant Sega stuff from when they were in their absolute pomp or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'll find plenty of Dreamcast love around here.
Yes.
I know Ditz is a huge Dreamcast fan as well. Did you have a Dreamcast, Strident?
No, I just missed that. Just got back into things just as it was dying off. I always thought it looked absolutely brilliant, and the a great little memory unit thing on top of control. I just think that's such a cool idea.
Yeah, it's a shame.
I was going to say it was a shame about the battery life on the visual memory unit, as it was called, because they used to eat up two CR2032 cells every sort of couple of weeks, yeah. which was a bit of a bind, to say the least.
Yeah, it was like a nightmare.
A Wii controller, then.
Yeah, could say that.
Yeah.
Right, now, we could wax lyrical about all of these classic consoles. We may well do another special show at some point, but what you'll talk about on this particular show is the 8-bit era. And just to explain the format, if you listen to Replay before, you know normally we pick an older game on the current generation and we play it as a community and then we come on and talk about it. We're doing it slightly differently here in that we're actually going to, each of us is going to list three seminal games that were important to us for various reasons during the 8-bit era. And give you an opportunity to actually play them yourself, because all of the games we're going to name today are available either via legal emulation or via compilations or platforms such as WiiWare, the virtual console. So everything we mentioned on this show, if you want to and you have the inkling, you can go out there and you actually play it today without dodgy ROMs or BitTorrent sites. So let's start off with Strident. So do you want to give us your first game, Strident, and just give us a bit of background as to why it's important for you?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I've tried to pick games that stand up well today and that are playable to a modern audience. Saying that, my first game doesn't fit those criteria. But I picked it because it was an important game in what was a very important genre for me at the time. I was on the 8-bit scene, I was really into text adventures. And you can't really talk about text adventures without mentioning one of the more successful ones, which was The Hobbit by Melbourne House. Released back in, I think, 1982, and based on the book The Hobbit. In fact, I think the early versions of the game actually came with the paperback The Hobbit book, and knowing if you've read the book, it would actually help you a lot with the game. Text adventures, for those people who don't know, I mean, just thinking about it, people are listening to this who are listening to us think, saying, what are they talking about, loading stuff from tapes, which I find unbelievable. Well, there you go, we do have some youngsters. Text adventures basically is just a game where it would describe on the screen locations by text, and you would interact with a computer by typing in simple verb noun instructions like get axe, kill dwarf with axe or whatever. So The Hobbit was one of the very, you know, first examples on the Spectrum, and a very, very successful example. I think it sold well over a million copies across all formats. It had some graphics, so some of the locations had graphics as well as text describing them, but they did take an age to sort of load, because they were sort of, they did the outline and then the Spectrum slowly filled in all the colours. It had all the characters, well, I say all the characters from a book. It had a Gandalf who basically was reduced to, I think, taking an object from you, looking at it and sort of giving it back. Mm-hmm. And it had only one dwarf, which, if you've read The Hobbit, I think that's pretty much a bonus. Only one dwarf, it was Thorin, who basically spent most of his time sitting down and singing about gold. But I mean, this text adventures are quite tricky to play these days. But if you back then, we didn't have anything like Game Facts or whatever. If you got stuck, you were really stuck. The most difficult part, I think, of a Hobbit was trying to get out of a goblin dungeon, which was especially difficult if you've managed to get Gandalf or Thorin killed, because you needed them to carry you on your back to get out. And it was quite a very strange game, because it was quite open, and the characters could do whatever they wanted. They could get into fights and they could actually die, and it was possible not to be able to complete the game if you managed to lose a character somewhere.
Well tested then.
Oh yeah, well, I suppose they thought at the time that they were being quite, you know, open, liberating, and it, you know, but you know, people could die. And I think back then, if you didn't finish the game, it was seen sort of your fault. You know, you're meant to look after these characters, and you know, it's your fault if you're not doing it right. I think it was also quite important game, because I think it was one of the very first ones that came with you could buy a strategy guide for. There was actually a little book, How to Play the Hobbit, which took you through, you know, each location and what you could do.
One of the other interesting things about The Hobbit or those text-based adventures of that era is that they spawned like a whole subgenre of educational games as well, didn't they? Like Granny's Garden and the Flowers of Crystal. If you guys remember playing those at school.
I've read since about Granny's Garden, and in America they had Oregon Trail, didn't they, which they often talk about on the American podcast. So I assume that was a text-based thing, although I'm not 100% sure. My main memory of text adventures before I had my own computer was seeing The Hobbit round friends' houses, and just everyone was into sort of testing the parser out. It was always about seeing what verbs and verb and noun combinations the game would recognise, whether it would be rude things, so you could insult them, enter swear words or whatever. But also it was just stuff. I remember my friend showing me it was something like kick Thorin or pick up Thorin, and
Yeah.
Stuff like that. And it was just the fun of actually finding out. When you were bored and stuck, you could at least sort of see what the writers had bothered to put in there as potential things for the player to do.
I think there is... sorry, Strian. I was going to say that there is actually a possibility of this genre actually coming back in a different form. I don't know if you guys have seen Scribblenauts for the,
yes,
for the DS.
Yes.
That's almost the same sort of concept.
I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah, you're basically just using nouns in that. But and I know those guys did a game before, didn't they? Was it Drawn to Life?
That's right.
Drawn to Life, yeah.
And they're planning on doing something similar, aren't they, next? So it's almost like there's a resurgence of that kind of creative emerging gameplay using words.
Well, I think like any of these, you know, older or forgotten genres, there are still people out there making them and then playing each other's games. I mean, even at the time, one of the big things about Spectrum and adventure games was there were several good adventure game creators on the market, pieces of software like the Quill and the Paw, and anyone could make a professional standard adventure game as long as they had some basic writing and spelling ability. They were really quite powerful tools, and you could produce a game that would stand up there alongside anything that any of the big companies would produce in terms of adventure games. And there was quite a flourishing Spectrum adventure scene, which I was a part of towards the end of the life of the Spectrum, that, you know, people like Zenobi releasing lots of really high quality games.
And talking of the resurgence the potential resurgence of text adventures, isn't there a rather successful reinvention of the Infocom, who were one of the biggest producers of text adventures? Their Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was remade, and it's available on possibly on the BBC website somewhere, and it's actually won interactive media awards and something, but it is basically a slightly graphicalized retelling of a classic text adventure.
Brilliant. Oh, that'd be brilliant if these could come back. And I could see it working on things like the iPhone quite well, because you've obviously got the built-in keyboard support and stuff on there. I know that things like Space Ace have made an appearance on there, so I don't think it's beyond the realms to have text-based adventures as well. Okay, thanks very much for that one, Striden. Ratso, do you want to give us your first one?
My first one is... I feel slightly bad about it, but I have such fondness for it that I don't really care, because it was effectively a clone of an arcade machine. But that's also why it's there in a way. It's a game called Drop Zone by Archer MacLean from 1985. It was released by US Gold and later re-released on their budget label Americana Software, which was always very cool and cheesy. It was Archer MacLean, who people may know more recently from Archer MacLean's Mercury and also various Jimmy White-based snooker and pool games. he was obviously a massive fan of Williams, particularly Eugene Jarvis's arcade output, so Defender and Stargate, and he set about making a clone, and the lead platform was the Atari 8-bit. He later ported it to the C64, but he always maintained that the Atari version was the best. In fact, in a famous interview in Zap 64 magazine in 1985, he upset a lot of Commodore 64 owners who bought that magazine by describing the Atari 8-bit as like a Ferrari or a Testarossa or something, and the Commodore 64 as a three-wheeled roller skate. And he put a lot of noses out of joint, but as an Atari, a sort of insecure Atari owner who was desperately sort of coveting lots of Commodore 64 games that I couldn't have on my system, that was music to my ears, to the point that I remembered that quote without having to look it up. So
you've not got a tattoo of it, have you?
Actually, that's not a bad idea. Still waiting to get a tattoo of something game related, and you might have just hit the nail on the head. Maybe it's a bit lengthy though. This was in the days, of course, and although this game didn't have this. This was in the days where you might buy a cassette, and again, this to our, some of our younger listeners may seem extraordinary, but game boxes were minuscule then, because they were the size of cassette tapes, which were invented in the 60s, weren't they, by Philips, I think, audio cassette tapes. And they would often have a flash on the front of the box in the early 80s saying things like 100% machine code, because it was implied, there was an implication that if it had because there were a lot of games commercially released that were programmed entirely in BASIC up to that point, and other sort of clunky languages. So 100% machine code generally implied at least sort of 30 frames a second and responsiveness and things like that. So he set about making this Defender clone, but the reason this game's so great is that he actually, to my mind, improved upon Defender and Stargate, which are classic arcade games. He added an element of risk and reward where instead of just protecting the men, you actually had to grab them from the floor and deposit them in a base. He improved the difficulty curve. He added a load of brilliant character on the enemies and animation. My favorite bit that I will always remember is between each round, your little man, rather than being a spaceship in Defender and Stargate, he's a little jetpack dude. And his legs used to curl up behind him as he jetted forward. The feeling of inertia was fantastic. But between rounds, my favourite thing was he used to lift his hand up and wipe his visor, which at the time, something like that was amazing. And I used to think he was scratching his nose, but then I realised he was wearing a space helmet, so he couldn't really scratch it. The sound was awesome. The little dudes, the little men, obviously people probably will remember the little men from Defender. If you don't know Defender, look it up. And that's also available on Xbox Live Arcade. The little men in Drop Zone used to do a little plaintive whistle when they were in trouble, when they were under attack. So instead of just getting a sort of aggressive attack noise from the enemy landers, you would actually get a little... And it would be sort of a call to arms, and you'd be jetting along the map. And after a few waves, the whistles would come thick and fast, and the whistles would be interrupting each other, and it would get more and more frantic. And yeah, it's just important in the sense that this was perhaps the first case that I ever saw of my home computer, instead of just poorly replicating the arcade experience, actually in some ways improved upon it visually and in terms of gameplay.
Thank you for that. Obviously, Archie MacLean is a very talented developer, isn't he? He's one of those that has actually survived from that 8-bit era. There aren't many, but there are a few.
He's an arcade collector as well, and restorer, which I really admire about him, the fact that he's still got the passion. He now has a huge collection of classic cabinets which he restores himself and stuff, which is brilliant.
Yeah, so it's yeah, and I actually remember playing Drop Zone myself on the Commodore 64 on a friend's one, and it was at the time a really cool game, and it really did feel like a genuine arcade quality game, because at the time, I mean, one of the hallmarks of the 8-bit era, especially the early 8-bit era, was really trying to emulate what you played down at your arcade.
Yeah,
and very few pulled it off, but like as you said, Drop Zone was as good, if not better. So
there were. People should be warned that although there are ways to play this, I don't know if we're going into that now or at the end. But there are ways to play the C64 version on various games that included it in some of the Jimmy White's games, and also in Pool Paradise, which is available on all the last gen formats pretty much. But there were sequels Super Drop Zone on the SNES, GBA and PlayStation 1 that really wasn't anything like as good as the original Drop Zone. He included power-ups and bosses and things like that, but it didn't really help. However, there was a game on the Amiga, slightly cheating on because that's a 16-bit game, but there was a spiritual successor by a Canadian developer called Data Storm, which did also include power-ups and bosses, but it was like it was basically Drop Zone 2 to all intents and purposes. It was awesome.
So if anyone does plan to pick this one up, so the best source of it is going to probably be Pool Paradise then, isn't it?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, it should be said that that is the inferior version to the Atari 8-bit version. It is the Commodore 64 version, and it's not supremely well emulated. But although we're avoiding, obviously, just plain piracy, if you own the ROM on C64 emulation, is it more legitimate to find the Atari 8-bit version and play that if you've bought a copy of Pool Paradise and the money's gone to Archer MacLean?
Possibly. I mean, if you could get an email from him saying I sanction this, I think that'd be all right.
Yeah, I bet he would.
He probably would, actually.
You'd possibly sleep at night, couldn't you? I don't think you'd lose sleep over
that. No, I think you'd be okay, yeah. But Pool Paradise, I imagine probably the PS2 version is the most widely available. So
easy to get, yeah. Easy to get hold of, and not much money either.
Excellent, okay. Moving on then to my first pick. So the game I've chosen is a game called Exelon, which actually came out on the Spectrum, Commodore 64, and the Amstrad CPCs. And it was converted as well to the Amiga and ST, although I never actually played it on that. And there is actually, if you dig around out there, there is actually a fully supported remake of Exelon as well, which you can download and try for the PC and Mac. The reason I've picked Exelon, first of all, it was published by Hewson, and Hewson were a real hallmark of quality for, certainly on the Spectrum, Amstrad and Commodore 64, and they brought out a whole range of games that were, you know, had superb gameplay and high quality polished presentation. Things like Nebulous and Cybernoid is one that a lot of people will remember. And the game was actually designed by Raphael Kecko. And the reason it's held with such high esteem on the Spectrum is that the ZX Spectrum had a fundamental flaw in the way in which colours were processed. And sometimes when you look at Spectrum screenshots, you'll notice that a lot of the games were actually developed in two colours, all monochrome. And that wasn't because it couldn't do the colours, it's because that when it did do the colours, there was a glitch, a bit of cheapness really in the graphics processor, which meant that certain colours, when they came close together, would form a large block on the screen, which was known as colour clash. And it was pretty horrendous. If you play some early Spectrum games that tried to have full colour sprites, you'd end up with this sort of blocky monstrosity crossing the screen. Now, the reason why this is held with such high esteem is that Exelon was one of the first games that was able to actually have full colour, but no colour clash, or in fact very little colour clash. There is a tiny bit if you look for it. And it's really down to the talents of its developer. And he went on to do Cybernoid 2 using the same engine, which again, on the Spectrum, just looked amazing. In fact, the Spectrum version is the one to play because it has the highest resolution and the most colours, in fact. And so,
Raphael Cecho, sorry.
Yeah, go.
I was going to say Raphael Cecho's games were notoriously difficult, weren't they?
They were. That's the only problem with it. They were very long and notoriously difficult. Yeah. So I think Exelon has 99 rooms or levels, effectively, and I don't think I've ever got any further than about 70. Yeah, they're very, very difficult. I mean, it's certainly high challenge. It's probably one of those things where it's almost impossible, I imagine, to get to the last one.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Cybernoid. I think I played that before Exelon, which is Cybernoid is that you've got a little spaceship, and I think I found that one a lot easier because I could have all sorts of stuff whirring around it to make it slightly easier for me to play. I mean, talking about sort of a graphical style, trying to get around the limitations of a Spectrum gave everything a sort of a very interesting artistic and stylistic design, you know, with a very black background and then very bright surrounding environments and very large main characters quite often in Exelon, but the character's huge, isn't he?
He's got
a proper, you know, it takes up, I suppose it might be a quarter of a screen or something, proper little you know, you can really see what he's getting up to.
Yeah, I like to think he's the original Master Chief, actually. If you look at the game design principles, you know, the character and the type of weaponry he's got and the way he jumps and animates, he almost is Master Chief, but in an 8-bit guise. You know, if you're going to remake Halo, I think it would actually look like Exelon. So yeah, that's my pick, my first game, and it's a game that I loved, even though it was nails difficult. Strident, would you like to give us your next game?
Yes, my next game is, again, it's quite a good seller, quite a popular one, is Head Over Heels, which was written by John Rittman and Bernie Drummond, who'd earlier produced what many might regard as one of the only decent Batman games that have ever been made. Head Over Heels, just like the early Batman game, was sort of an isometric adventure, graphical adventure type, arcade adventure, whatever they used to call it back then. So it's from a fixed perspective with a sort of fake 3D, very similar to Ultimate's Nightlaw and some of their earlier titles. Basically, you control two characters. You control Head and heels, and they're trapped in a castle, and you have to get them out. And there's some plot involving overthrowing an alien overlord or something, but you basically have to get them from where they start to the win room. It's a really clever sort of puzzle game, because you control two characters. You can switch between them at will. They start in completely separate parts of the castle. They both have their own unique abilities. So Head is quite good at jumping. He can also sort of glide as well. And later on you can pick up a gun that shoots donuts. That sounds a bit silly, but it's one of the more sensible things in the game. Heels is a lot faster than Head. Heels is like a little dog that runs around, and he also can get a bag later on that can pick up objects. So they both have very different ways of solving puzzles. Now, you spend the first part of the game moving through the castle separately, and occasionally you'll go through rooms and you can say, oh gosh, that's where Head came through earlier on, or Heels went through that tunnel. But eventually you reach a point where you meet for two characters, and when you're in a section where you meet, they actually, well, Head rides on top of Heels like a horse, and then their abilities are actually combined. So now you've got a character with all the best parts of what Head can do and all the best parts of what Heels can do, which it sort of opens up some very interesting puzzle elements. And then the game forces you to split them up again, and one has to go one way and one goes the other, and then it brings them back again. So you're constantly puzzle solving. There's all sorts of, I mean, graphically it's very cool. There's all sorts of strange, bizarre things in there. You collect fluffy bunnies for your lives. There's reincarnation fishes that you collect, and that creates sort of like a save point that you can go back to. You're shooting donuts. There's Prince Charles headed Daleks, teleporters. You travel. It's just lots of good puzzles to solve. You spend a lot of time picking up blocks and stacking them, jumping over objects, pressing switches, rolling balls around to try and trap enemies. There's floating platforms, there's conveyor belts and all sorts. It's a very nice little puzzle game, and it stands up very well today. I think with having two characters, I sort of would call it a single-player co-op game. I could never see two people working together enough to control one each, but it has those sort of elements that you'd look for in a really good co-op game.
I think it actually does represent the peak of the isometric arcade adventure genre. I think the puzzles were and are still genius. I've played the remake that you're probably going to point people towards shortly. And it does stand up in many ways. A couple of interesting things about it is that from my point of view, it was never released at full price on either of my first two computers. It was released only on the Hit Squad Ocean's budget label for my Atari 8-bit for $2.99, which was a bit of a result. And then the Amiga version also was released on the $7.99 Hit Squad budget label, but it was a pure fan project. It was actually done purely out of love by a couple of blokes, I think, or maybe even one bloke, and they sent it to Ocean, who had no plans to convert it to the Amiga at all, and it was such an accurate and lovingly made version that they decided to publish it.
Yeah, like you said, a lot of people did love that game, and there is a PC remake which it plays pretty well with high quality graphics and everything, but it's still essentially the same game underneath the glossy core.
Yeah, just to add to what Ratso said there, I've got really fond memories of Head Over Heels as well. I love that game. I love Batman before it as well, which was very similar. And I still actually love the art style, that kind of isometric view. I know you can get... sometimes I pick up magazines, and they've done, some sort of publicity image in that isometric viewpoint, and it always just fills me with nostalgia and fond memories. I absolutely love it. And... the remake is available for PC and Mac, but I think it is actually well worth playing the an emulated version of the Spectrum or Commodore 64 version as well, just to see how good it looked even on an 8-bit machine, really. Okay, thanks Dryden. Right, so do you want to give us your next one?
Yeah, my second one is, think back to a time when Activision was not synonymous with Guitar Hero or DJ Hero, but just a game called Hero, which was rather clumsily given a horrible backronym or three, where they obviously just wanted to call the game Hero, but they in fact did it H.E.R.O. and then made up a load of words like helicopter equipped rescue operation or helicopter emergency rescue op, human extraction, blah blah blah. Actually, this is kind of Activision. This is Activision like maybe three or four incarnations ago, before they became all kinds of different things and were bought and sold and changed their name. And even a few years after this, they started becoming more known for their slightly tawdry and cheap cash-in arcade conversions and things like that. But this was a point when they were releasing all kinds of interesting games across various formats, particularly the Atari VCS, but also on the C64, games like Zengi and Park Patrol as well, and a lot of the stuff that you'll find on the Activision Anthology compilation, which is Atari 2600 emulation, which is where you can find this. Unfortunately, I don't think it's legal to play the Atari 8-bit version that I'm talking about. What it was you controlled, again, a little dude. Maybe I've got a thing about games where you control little dudes. Actually, maybe just a lot of games involve you controlling little dudes. You had a gyropack, a helicopter gyropack on your back, so you had it was a pretty weird feeling game to control, actually, because you would get almost no response from the controller for a couple of seconds, and then you would kind of lurch. And that sounds awful, but actually, with time and practice, you could actually put quite a high level of skill and control into your little man. The things that made it fun to play and the things that hooked you was probably the fact that it had a score time attack thing going on. So you could rush to the end of the level. Each level was made up of umpteen flick screens, which became increasingly hazardous as the game progressed. And you would have destructible walls and lava on the floor and magma walls and things like that. There'd be beasties on the way, spiders and flying things. And you had a little tiny gun that just shot out just in front of you. But you also had a dynamite stick, which was fantastic. You could, by pulling down on the stick or the pad or whatever you're using to control it, it would have been a joystick, wouldn't it? drop the dynamite, and then you had to run away, because this was one of the first times I ever remember coming across an area of effect weapon in a video game. So instead of just total pixel perfect collision detection, this you actually had to put the dynamite down, it would burn down, you'd run away. And part of the skill to getting high scores would be knowing exactly how far to step away from your dynamite before wheeling immediately back and through the rock that you just destroyed. It had what I like to think of as real-time dynamic lighting. Actually, all it was there were lanterns in the cave simply drawn on the walls. And if you accidentally shot them, the screen would go dark. and it would then only show up certain bits of the background in grey and certain baddies, so you could make it really hard for yourself on certain screens. So you'd traverse through the magma and the lava and the beasties. There was if people know Joust, as William's coin-op, I think I already mentioned it, with the buzzards, the jousting, there was a lava pit at the bottom of that with a hand that would come out and grab your mount's feet, and this had a similar thing in the undercaves, which would a spooky hand that would come out and grab your little gyro man, your little hero's feet, just to keep you on your toes so you couldn't rely on just scraping along the bottom all the time. And it's still really fun. I played it for many hours, and this was quite a few years after it came out as well, so it was already a bit dated. And obviously the Atari 2600 version that's available on the Activision Anthology looks ancient. It really does, but I think it holds up. I'm not sure everyone would agree.
It's not one I've played myself. Yourself, Strahd?
No, I've seen video. I mean, a lot of these games, it's quite good if you go to YouTube. You can actually watch YouTube videos of people playing them. I've seen people play it, and they're just racing through these, navigating their way through these screens, firing missiles or whatever they've, you know, the weapon is at a tremendous pace. It looks incredibly frantic, and it looks like the type of game that I probably wouldn't have got past the second screen on the thing.
It was quite
not improved.
It wasn't too hard. I mean, the first few levels weren't too hard. I did mention is that your dynamite, although your gun was infinite ammo, your dynamite was limited and your power was limited, and your score was calculated based on how much power you had at the end, but it was the constant gamble between staying around to try and shoot the little monsters and beasties against actually getting to the end and getting your your countdown, your remaining power added to your score. So I guess maybe that was as much the hook as anything, the scoring system.
Excellent. Okay, thank you very much for that one. And as you said, that one's available on pretty much everything on the Activision Anthology. Probably the easiest one to get hold of, I imagine, probably be the PS2 or the PSP version.
Yeah.
Okay. Brings me on to my second game. My second game is called The Sacred Armor of Antiriad. And, probably the first thing to point out is actually where I get my alias or my gamertag from. My gamertag is Xantiriad. It's basically Antiriad with an X on the front. Now, the Sacred Armor of Antiriad is basically like a side-scrolling adventure puzzle game, I suppose. And actually, it bears an uncanny resemblance to Metroid. Really, the main difference is being the setting. It's basically set in a kind of irradiated ancient Earth. But in a similar vein to Metroid, it's one where you have to first of all obtain your suit and your powers so that you can then proceed to later areas. Although it's very, very similar to Metroid, it isn't actually a Metroid clone at all. The two games actually came out within a month or so of each other. Obviously, Antiriad came out in Europe on the Amstrad, Commodore 64 and Spectrum, and Metroid came out in Japan on the NES, and the NES wasn't even available in much of Europe at the time. So it's one of those cases of, you know, it's very similar games coming out, but actually there being no connection between that. One of the reasons I personally really enjoyed it was that, again, it had a very distinctive art style and was extremely colourful. In some ways, quite similar to Exelon in terms of as Strymon was talking about, the contrasting colours. And I just found it a really intriguing concept. The rumour is that the actual name of the title of the game is actually a misspelling. It should have been Antirad, but they misspelled it and called it Antiriad. And because actually your suit is called an Antirad suit. So that's another sort of funny quirk. And that's really why I've always used it as an alias. I've used Antiriad and Xantiriad as an alias for the best part of 25 years. Again, you can get it legal emulation on certainly on the Spectrum, and I believe on the Amstrad and Commodore 64 as well. And there is a long-held rumour that Psygnosis, who are now Sony Liverpool, they made a game called Shadow of the Beast in the, I think, late 80s, early 90s. And it's heavily rumoured that that actually this game was the inspiration for that. So I like to think that's true.
Well, I remember about Sacred Armor of Antiriad. It's a game I've never played. But, my friend Simon, who's also known as Spoon6, he does all our music at Gamer.org now, he had this on the Commodore 64, and it's interesting that you should liken it to Super Metroid, because he said that he would replay it and replay it, and I guess he was doing what we would call now a speed run. He was getting faster and faster at doing all the bits, to the point that I think you can actually, as with Super Metroid, you can get it down to something like 2 or 3 hours, can't you, if you know exactly where to go?
Yeah, a friend actually, when I was at primary school, could do that. I mean, I never actually attempted that myself, but he played it so much that he could literally just, he would know pixel perfect every single screen what he had to do, and he could blast through it in a couple of hours. Yeah, it's very similar. I mean, I said gameplay wise they are very, very similar. It's uncanny, really.
Yeah, I mean, again, that one, it's got another, it's a great big main character. He's a very detailed animations, absolutely very brilliant. His animations are running. I think I can remember his hair bouncing up and down, and he's throwing the stones and things. It's just an incredibly well animated, detailed main character. I just love the story behind it, the idea that, you know, after some sort of apocalypse or whatever, this armor would be left behind, and the natives would find it and you know, and bring it back to use to overthrow their evil oppressors. I never got particularly far in it, but it was great the way you would use the armor for some sections, and then you'd have to step out of it and go and find some more power or go through a force field. It's a good little game.
Sorry, I forgot to mention, actually, I just opened the Wikipedia page. First of all, that in the US it was released under a different name, which was Rad Warrior. And secondly, mm-hmm. that it came with a 16-page comic book, and I've only just remembered that. It came in one of those double cassettes, and it had a little tiny comic book in it, a little tiny graphic novel. I'd completely forgotten that.
It's also worth mentioning that Wikipedia says that the Metroid coincidence thing is probably a coincidence due to the similar release frame time of Metroid 1 coming out in Japan and Anterior coming out for the first time over here. So they probably, it wasn't a case of, because Nintendo have in the past not been above ripping off Western ideas and taking them to Japan, such as Joust becoming Balloon Fight and things like that. But I guess it was coincidence in this case.
Yeah, it looks that way. Yeah, I'll just reading that bit now. Yeah, yes, that's good to know. Okay, right. Let's move on to our last nominations. So let's start off with Strident, and I'm very pleased you put this on the list, Strident, because this one narrowly escaped mine, and it's a game I've completed about 10 times, and even as recent as 6 months ago.
I must admit, when I was playing it the other day in preparation for this, and I could have quite easily sat on it for a couple of hours just trying. The game is The Great Escape, which is by Denton Designs, I think, and sort of loosely inspired by this film. I think it certainly shares the title and shares the theme music, at least. You played a German prisoner of war, and you had to escape from a prison camp. And, I mean, that's basically all there is to it. It's an electronic recreation of a German prison camp. It's basically, I think if you were going to describe it in today's terms, you would say it was an open world stealth adventure game. You would wander around the camp, following the routines of the camp. The guards would be following their set patrol paths, and you basically had to look for openings to escape. You looked for times where you could go into the building of a prison and go around and find objects that would allow you to escape, things like a spade to clear the blockages in the tunnel, lockpick kit, a torch, chocolate to bribe the guards, ID papers, German uniform, wire cutters, money, food. Red Cross parcels came every so often. And that's what you had to do. If you got caught with any of these objects, they'd be taken off you, you'd be thrown into solitary, your morale would dip a bit, and that was quite an interesting idea, actually. Your morale was shown by a flag on a flagpole on the left-hand side of the screen, and every time you got captured, it would slowly drop, and if it got to the bottom, then it would be game over. That flag also turned green or red, depending on whether you were going places where you shouldn't. The great thing about it, and without this it would have been really tedious, I think, is that if you just stop pressing on the keyboard, your little person, the computer, would make him follow his daily routine. So you didn't have to worry about, oh, it's roll call now, where's the roll call place? The computer would actually walk him round what he should be doing, and you got to choose when you wanted to deviate from that path, which was a really, really good feature. There was several different ways of escaping and several different endings depending on what items you escape with. There was only a couple of perfect possibilities to actually get out without being shot or shot as a spy or getting lost, which was a really good thing. And you could just literally spend hours sitting there playing this game. Very, very good game.
Yeah.
I was just going to warn people off, if anyone comes across the game Prisoner of War by Codemasters on the last gen machines, which purports to do pretty much exactly the same things, avoid that one. It's terrible.
Yeah, there was another remake, wasn't there? There was another game called The Great Escape, which again was pretty rubbish, pretty hopeless. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the definitive The Great Escape game, definitely.
It wasn't an official film license, though, at all, was it? It was it was in the days where you could just call it the same thing and no one cared, probably. I don't know,
because it did have the Great Escape theme music, so I don't know. They certainly didn't use any of the likeness from the film. There was no sort of Steve McQueen motorbike anywhere, so...
There was no film company logo anywhere on it. I don't think it was a license. I think this was just in the days where computer games were so unimportant that you could get away with doing things like that.
And probably license for music independently, maybe, and go to whoever composed that and say, "Can we use it, please?"
Yeah.
I think the other thing to point out is it was almost the beginnings of point and click adventures as well. it was the similar concept in that you had these, you know, static rooms with items that you could pick up and you could combine and use. So it was well ahead of its time again, I think it stands up well today if you play it now. I really do. And I was mentioning to you, didn't I, Striden, the other day that they did a sequel called Where Time Stood Still, which was, you know, inspired by those kind of 60s dinosaur flicks.
Yeah. If you like Journey to the Center of the Earth and all that sort of thing.
And it was a much bigger game. First of all, it was on the 128K Spectrum. And I think it was two tapes, if I remember right, as well. And that was equally good, but actually a lot harder. And you actually had lots of different characters that you had to use. And different characters could do different things and carry different items. But yeah, great game. Ratso, do you want to give us your final one, and your final one is something a bit special as well in the annals of gaming history.
Yeah, it certainly is. It's been converted to everything ever, probably, and been sequeled and all kinds of things. It's the version I'm talking about, again, because I have fond memories of the Atari 8-bit version, is certainly not the best, but it's valid anyway. It was a decent conversion. That's Gauntlet, the conversion of the 1985 Atari coin-op. Gremlin Graphics handled it, but it was released for US Gold. They had the license, but they farmed out the conversion for some reason. I remember the previews were talking about how the 8-bit home versions were going to include all the speech. And then they all came out, they had no speech in, not a single word of speech at all. To lies. Actually, it should be said that there were better conversions for Spectrum, particularly in the Amstrad CPC 464, and there was a decent but rather buggy one for the Commodore 64, and another great 8-bit version. Actually, probably the best 8-bit version was on the Master System. So this was a game that was a top-down hybrid of RPG and shoot 'em up, really. It took a lot of the Dungeons and Dragons tropes, put them in a game that was actually not so dissimilar to something like Robotron, as in a top-down arena-based shooter, but you had larger levels. You had keys and doors and coins and jugs of cider and plates of meat, and you had four independently skilled characters, Valkyrie, Warrior, Wizard and Elf. They each had different starting attributes, which you could augment with special potions. There were treasure rooms. It had amazing speech, amazing graphics for the time, extremely high-res looking game for 1985. But a couple of the key things that it introduced, the reason that it's really worth remembering and talking about, it arguably invented microtransactions, this game, in 1985, which people will probably be surprised by. In that, coins equaled health. So you could carry on playing as long as you kept feeding money into the machine. It was always interesting to see which arcade owners were more generous, or perhaps just hadn't observed their machines being played as much, because the default health that you got for 20p would vary wildly between different arcades. So you might go into one arcade, put in 20p and have 800 health, and another you might have 2000 or something. And then when you fed in further coins, and we're talking the big heavy old fat 10p coins, you might get another 800 health, or maybe it would be another 1000. I think they could just alter the dip switches accordingly. The other real major thing about Gauntlet is it was the game which, if not invented, then it certainly popularized co-op play, because at the arcade you could have up to four people at the same time around this one massive cabinet. I think there was also a two-player cabinet, but I don't think I ever saw one in Brighton, where we were lucky enough to have tons and tons of well-stocked arcades. There were several of the four-player machines, and I wish I had one of those babies.
Yeah.
It was two players on all the 8-bit machines, as far as I recall. One tiny little story about this game was that I was so excited about getting this game. I got it home. I think I ordered it through the post, as I recall, and it basically destroyed my revision for my biology GCSE final, because I played it for 8 hours, as I regularly did, played it 8 hours non-stop. When you got to the end, all that happened was the last level repeated, but in different orientations over and over again. So there was no real completion. The home conversions were so easy as well that you could easily rack up the maximum health of 9999 and keep it topped up. because the home conversions were just so much slower. The coin-op, as you can imagine, as is often the case, was much faster and much more brutal. But when I first got my game home, it had one of these Atari multi-loads. So the initial game took something like 12 minutes to load, and then it would load in sets of about four levels at a time, with a 3 or 4 minute cassette load. And I just could not work out how this was going to work. So I'd keep completing the first set of levels that were in the first load, which I think were the first eight levels. And then I just couldn't get it to load the rest of the levels. So I actually phoned up US Gold in a teary panic, going, you know, I can't play Gauntlet. And they actually, the receptionist put me straight through to the programming team, the Gremlin Graphics programming team, which would never happen now. And I actually spoke to, I think it was Bob Armour, who was dealing with the Atari 8-bit version and some of the others, and he actually said, you need to turn the cassette over. So blessed. That was great memories, and it's still available in many ways, including Xbox Live Arcade. It's on Midway Arcade Treasures compilation for all the last gen machines and PC, and Gauntlet 2 is available on PSN.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's interesting. I played the Xbox Live Arcade version. I thought, gosh, I used to be brilliant at Gauntlet. This will be a great game for me to buy on the arcade. And then I was just appallingly bad at it, mainly because I was playing on my own. I think I always used to play Gauntlet on the 8-bits with my dad. But obviously, if you say that the 8-bit versions were a lot slower, that was it. You know, I haven't got that much worse at playing games. It was because the game I was used to was a lot slower. I think one of the interesting things about Gauntlet is the way that there was, you know, several sequels to it on the 8-bit machines, including, I suppose you say, unofficial sequels, in that they weren't mirroring the arcade machine. You've got things like the Deeper Dungeon. I think Gauntlet 2 was that. I don't think it was a direct copy of the arcade, but it had, you know, lots of new elements in it, and they did that quite a lot with arcade games that were hits on the home consoles. They'll produce a completely different spin-off sequel that had no equivalent game in the arcade.
Yeah, there was a horrible sort of isometric-y Gauntlet 3 on the 16-bit computers. It all got a bit confusing. Gauntlet 4 on the Mega Drive was actually Gauntlet 1 and a really good version, but it also had a sort of RPG, a more heavy RPG aspect to it as well. And there were several later coin-ops which were converted to things like the N64 and the Dreamcast, but I didn't really get into those. And there was even a recent DS, a new DS game, but its release has been cancelled, I believe.
Yeah, I saw that, and some of the early video of that looked quite good. Actually, it looked like it was in the spirit of the original.
Yeah,
it's a pity. Yeah. Mm. You mentioned Strident about some of the games getting unofficial 8-bit sequels. One game that probably mentioned a little bit later when we talk about things that didn't make the list was Target Renegade, which did have, I believe, it did have a cabinet originally, but there was about 3 or 4 sequels on the 8-bit systems that never came out as arcade sequels. So it just shows, doesn't it, if sometimes these games actually take off on the home computer or the home console far more than they did in the arcades. Right. Okay, so it brings me on to my last one. A bit of an unusual one, this one, and one actually that probably passed many people by at the time, because it didn't sell terribly well, and it was directly up against a much bigger, more well-known game. The game's called Overlander, and the game it was up against was actually an arcade game called Road Blasters, which some of you may remember.
Yes, now, big fan.
Yeah, I love Road Blasters in the arcade especially. Now, the reason why I picked this was, first of all, I felt it necessary to pick a driving game, just for balance, really. And secondly, because there have been so many terrible ones, particularly on the Spectrum and the Commodore 64. I think maybe with the exception of Chase HQ, most of the conversions from the arcade were pretty ropey. And infamously, Outrun was appallingly bad on the Spectrum. If you want to see a really terrible conversion, then look at the conversion of Outrun on the Spectrum. It is absolutely dire. It was so bad that they took all the music out and they gave you a music cassette with it to play along as you played it. You know, that was.
I used to love that cassette. Yeah, I think I've still got it somewhere.
That was the only good thing, was you could listen to whatever it was, the Sunshine Dream Splash or whatever it was, you know, whatever you liked, you know. But and it really. And Road Blasters, I've just said, was one of my favourite games in the arcade. I love Road Blasters, and played it to death, places like Folkestone Arcade when I was a kid. And the Spectrum version that I bought and loved, but it just wasn't the same. It wasn't as good. And a small game came out, published by Elite, called Overlander, which was revolutionary. It not only was the driving mechanics in it really good and really easy to play, it was similar to Road Blasters, you're basically a road warrior, you know, Mad Max style. But it introduced concepts like rewards for succeeding after each level, an actual purpose. There's actually, you know, there is actually a story behind what you're trying to do. It's not something that just goes on and on like a coin up would do to try to swallow your money. And it actually had not only proper parallax scrolling, but it also had up and down, which was revolutionary then. Most driving games were on a very flat track normally, or a flat surface, but Overland actually had hills and gradient that affected both how your car handled and what you could do. And I just absolutely loved that game, and it was one that just, you know, because it didn't have the name, it didn't sell, and it was such a shame because it was such a high quality product. And I know you mentioned to me, Striden, that it's not one you'd come across before.
It wasn't. I mean, I looked it up on Wikipedia, and I don't think it even has a Wikipedia page, which is so unusual. I played Road Blasters, and that was so slow on the 8-bit machines. And I gave Overlander a bit of a try on emulation recently, but I was really bad at playing it. But I can see why, you know, because you got to choose how you equipped your car and things, didn't you, and what special weapons you loaded into it, and it had a real sort of how you spend your money and some sort of tactical element to it. So it looked like a decent game, but playing it now, it was pretty tricky.
I don't know if I'm right on this, but I do remember the C6. I never played Overlander. I was a massive, and still am a massive, Road Blasters fan. It was one of the last coin-ops of that era to leave the arcades of Brighton. I could still play it up until maybe sort of about 8 or 9 years ago. But
it was a great game.
I think the Commodore 64 version of Overlander was meant to be awful compared to as is often the case with 3D stuff, the C64 didn't handle it very well, so much as with the conversions of things like Space Harrier. It was actually the Enduro Racer, famously, the Spectrum version of Enduro Racer was they did a pretty amazing job with what was at the time a top end coin op, whereas the C64 version was a brutally ugly mess. And I think Overlander maybe suffered a similar fate in terms of frame rate and stuff like that, but I couldn't swear to it.
No, I remember at the time, because I had friends who had Commodore 64s and who also had it, and I do remember seeing it and going, oh god, that looks awful. Mm-hmm. I remember it because that was the weird thing with that era, was that some of the home computers, like the Spectrum for example, had, to be honest, crap colours, because it, you know, had the issues of colour clash, and so many games opted for monochrome, but it had much higher resolution, so and as you said, it had a much better processor for handling things like parallax scrolling and sort of phony 3D. So it was always interesting to see on which platform the game worked best, and for many games like this, it was the Spectrum.
Yeah, I mean, Road Blasters, it wasn't a bad game on the Spectrum. It just was a completely different game because of the speed. I mean, it was still a brilliant playable game on the Spectrum.
Yep.
But if you went into the arcade and played it afterwards, you wouldn't recognise it, because just the speed is so intense in that arcade version.
Yeah.
Speech and the colours.
I loved Road Blasters, I must admit. I did love the Spectrum version as well, but Overlander for me topped it, but it was a close run thing. Okay, so those are our three games. I'll just quickly run through for everyone who wants to join in. We'll post some stuff on the site, probably on the blog, just so you know where to find these. But all the games that Striden and myself named are all available for legal emulation from worldofspectrum.org. You can download an emulator, and then you can download... The best thing to do, actually, for the full experience, is to download the TZX file, is it? Let me get that right. You want the TZX file, which is actually an image of the tape, so you will actually load the tape for the full, you know, 7-minute wait.
I'd about to say most decent emulators will let you speed that up
you can speed it up, but it is fun to sit through just to appreciate it, and it won't the tape won't bugger up towards the end either, so
change the volume halfway through,
so you'll smack the table and the cable comes out. So just run through those. So that was Exelon, Sacred Armor of Antiriad, Overlander, The Hobbit, The Great Escape, and Head Over Heels. It's also worth pointing out that both Exelon and Head Over Heels have had PC Mac remakes, which will run on virtually any PC and any Mac, and we'll put a link to those in the notes. Ratso's choices are much more eclectic, and so Drop Zone, as we said earlier, probably the best bit there is Paul Paradise on the PS2, but it's also available on the GameCube, which you can use on the Wii and the PC. Hero on the Activision Anthology, and that's for the PC, Mac, PSP, PS2, GBA, and DS if you've got a DS with a GBA slot. And Gauntlet, of course, you can find everywhere. So you've got the arcade version on the Xbox 360. You've got it in the Midway Arcade Treasures on the PC, PS2, GameCube, Wii, Xbox, but not backwards compatible on the 360. And then you've got Gauntlet 2 available on PSN. That might be a good one to try, actually.
Yeah, it's a good game, the second one, actually. It's got some... they added a bunch of new stuff.
Yeah, and Gauntlet also and Gauntlet 2 are both available for legal emulation via World of Spectrum as well. The license holders have been very... Midway have been very kind and allowed those to be downloaded and used. Hello, it's Dan Tyrell again, better known as Zan, and it's my pleasure to welcome Silverfin. Silverfin, unfortunately, because of a Skype mess-up, was unable to join the live recording, but we've managed to get Skype working, and I thought I'd just have a chat with Silverfin about his three game nominations from the 8-bit era, which you can all download and enjoy as well. So, welcome, Silverfin, how are you?
I'm great, thanks, Zan. Thanks for having me on. Sorry about the problems we had.
That's my pleasure. Would you like to tell us what the first game is that you want to talk about?
Sure. So the first game I want to talk about is one of the first games I got for the Commodore 64 after my parents were kind enough to buy me one when I was 8 years old, and that was Impossible Mission, which was developed by Epnix and came out just the start of 1984. But my memory's a bit hazy in those days because I was a bit young.
Yeah.
I mean, the best way I can sum up Impossible Mission is it's an unforgiving platformer. We often have games come out these days that tend to be very simple, very easy to get into, take you by the hand and lead you in. But Impossible Mission was one of the hardcore platformers that came out right at the very start of the C64. Basically, it was a standard story for those days. There was an evil dictator who was trying to take over the world, and you had to break into his lab and put together a puzzle. Which once you put together the puzzle, then allowed you access to the final areas to defeat the boss. It was the game they picked first because it's quite accessible, really. If anyone wants to pick it up, it's available on the Virtual Console on the Wii. But also because it stuck in my mind due to the use of sound in the game. It was one of the first games that I can remember that used sampled speech. So when you started the game, you would have a bit of sampling saying, stay a while, stay forever. And when you're 8 years old and you open up your first computer game, that takes you by surprise. Think, wow, that's just amazing. So that was the first reason, or second reason I picked it. Third reason was graphics, really. So playing it again in the Wii, it's amazing how much some of the character animation still stands up the test of time. So as well as having great playability, quite unforgiving though, but the actual animation of the main character was very, very good for 1984. I don't know if they used motion capture, or I think it was called rotoscoping in those days.
Yeah, it has a kind of Prince of Persia look to it, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I think that's a very good comparison. And like the original Prince of Persia, it can be a bit unforgiving as well, where you fall off platforms all the time. And you'd run into robots in this copy. But I think it's a great game, even now, to pick up for people. The other thing about it I found interesting, which I'd completely forgotten, was that it totally removed the idea of lives from the game, which is obviously really popular in those days. You did your three lives for each game, but this one, you get a 6-hour game time limit, and every time you die, it takes off 10 minutes of your time. So you can make several mistakes before you finally will have used up all your time. I think in total it took about 30 to 45 minutes to complete the game if you knew exactly what you were doing. But, all in all, it was an excellent game. I loved it at the time, and playing it again in the Wii Virtual Console, thought it was great still.
Excellent. That's, yeah, as you say, it's available on the Wii Virtual Console. Do you know how much that is?
It was 500 points, I think.
Which is, it's about £3, isn't it? That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very similar to it's very like a mobile game. If you want to pick something up and play it, it can be good for that. But if you want to play it through, which it really deserves, it deserves to be played a bit more. But it's very accessible.
Excellent. Okay. So moving on to your second game. Would you like to tell us what that one is?
So the second one I picked was The Sentinel.
Classic game.
Yeah, it was awesome. And I have such great memories of this, and just the first one was being blown away by the graphics, which when you load it up now, you think, what, really? this was good. But I think it was one of the first games to really show off 3D graphics in an 8-bit game. I don't really remember many other games trying to build 3D landscapes at that time.
I'm trying to think of the name of it now. I might look it up, actually. It used a special technique, didn't it, to render the world as well? Let me just quickly look it up on Wikipedia.
Well, I did read that Jeff Cremond, who's a developer, he was a physics graduate. So it was quite possible he came up with some super physics to get the most out of the machine.
Yeah, I can't find it at the moment. But yeah, it's Jeff Cremond went on to have quite a career as well, because he obviously did things like Stunt Car Racer and Formula One on the PC and some other great games. Yeah, that was it. Certainly was one of my favourite games, actually, on the Spectrum. And yeah,
and it was probably faster in the Spectrum than it was in the 64.
We discussed that a little bit earlier, actually, on the show with Ratso and Striden, that some games work better on one machine than the other, and things that required a lot of 3D seem to suffer a bit on the Commodore 64 for some reason.
They did, yeah. But it was one of those games that I thought, and probably still is, it was a game that was really ahead of its time because of the technology. Jeff Cremond obviously was a really creative guy. And as you said, Zan, he did Stunt Car Racer, he did F1 GP, all which were great games. And you can see that he was trying to really push the envelope with the hardware he had. For anyone who hadn't played it, the basic premise was, story aside obviously, because the story is always crazy in these games, is start at the bottom of the landscape and work to the top of the landscape and try to absorb the energy around you and trees and boulders, and eventually by building other things with your energy you got higher than the Sentinel, and you absorbed the Sentinel and moved on to the next level. When I was doing my notes, I was trying to think really how to describe it, and there isn't really a way to describe it easily. I think it's a game that you do have to play to see how it works. But it's very accessible. It's on I found a Flash copy of it, which was the one I played rather than the Lemon 64 versions.
Yep.
So it's easy enough to get a hold of these days.
And I suppose the easiest way to describe it, it's a bit like hide and seek, isn't it? But
that's a good way.
Sort of 3D world, yeah. There's quite a lot of puzzle elements. I seem to remember, it's been a long time since I played it, wasn't there these crystals that you had to absorb? Was that the same game?
I think in the later levels there may have been. I think I played 10 levels, 10 or 11 levels before the show. The landscape at that point was just boulders and trees to try and then build up to the Sentinel's level. But a bit like Impossible Mission and IK Plus, which would be the third game, what really helped in this game, because it took 3 seconds to render the screen in the C64. So
yeah.
you change your view and then wait 3 seconds while it recalculated everything. but what really got me was the sound. And it builds atmosphere through excellent use of sound as the Sentinel rotates, because as soon as it sees you, it starts to absorb your energy and you've got to either panic and hit a hyperspace button and transport to a random location on the map, or try to move away very quickly. The noise, the grating kind of noise it makes as the sensor rotates, and then the buzzing noise is just excellent for building atmosphere. And I think with all the 8-bit games that I played, and the other ones I played which I didn't select, that was a common theme, was that these guys didn't have access to this fantastic graphics or multi-million pounds, but what they did was make great use of sound, where they weren't able to use all these modern techniques that we have today.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, and your third game is another game that I really enjoyed. But actually, I'll be honest with you, I played that a lot on the Amiga. But do you want to tell us what that one is?
Oh yeah, International Karate Plus, or IK Plus. Unlike you, Zan, I played it on the Amiga as well. After I graduated up from the 64, but I think this. I don't know who will agree or disagree with me, but I think this was the definitive beat 'em up for the 8-bits. Across all the platforms, and even into the Amiga and STH as well. I mean, this was the game that everyone wanted to play. This came out in the back of 1987 for the 64, and followed up the original IK game, and I think was the first one to use three players. So instead of the standard two player beat 'em up, you had three players, two humans against the PC, or two PC characters against you. And again, great use of sound in the game. I can still feel it in my stomach when my little character in the Wii Virtual Console gets hit. Just the pow noise it makes was just fantastic. And although it lacked a bit of variety in what it was in what you could do with it, it was a beat 'em up. It just got harder and harder and harder. And it was quite a steep learning curve. But the amount of playability that Archie MacLean managed to pull out of those machines was incredible. So he got 12 moves in the days when we had one button instead of six or eight buttons in our joypads. He got 12 individual moves out of a single button joystick when everybody else was still five or six moves per game, with games like Way of the Exploding Fist.
Yeah.
I just thought it still sticks out for me as being the best game I played in the 64, and latterly in Amiga, it was one of the best games as well. And for something you can pick up on the Virtual Console for 500 points for the Wii, it's great. I play it probably two or three times a week as I'm waiting for.
That's a proper fan.
It is. Well, I tend to get maybe 5 or 10 minutes just after the kids have gone to bed, go downstairs, waiting for things to happen in the house, switch on the Wii, 5 minutes. IK Plus, it's great, particularly this couple of weeks because my 360 is off with the E74 error.
Oh,
so I've got nothing else to do but switch on the Wii. But yeah, I think this is a brilliant game. If you only buy one game for the Wii Virtual Console for the C64, for me it has to be IK Plus. It's just tremendous playability and very easy to get into.
Excellent. And one of the things we also discussed is games that didn't quite make the list. Are there any games that, you know, for various reasons, like it's not available for legal emulation or on the virtual console, that you'd have liked to have picked and didn't make the list?
So there were a couple. The emulation thing is obviously very, very tricky, because you're never quite sure. I don't think even on some of the sites out there if things are legally emulated or not. There were a couple of games, though Last Ninja was one of them, particularly Last Ninja 3, which I think was the best one for the platform. But I think the time that we had just to prepare for the show and the time we have to set aside to do it, it would not do that game justice.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's available on the Virtual Console too, if anyone wants to have a look at it. It's just an excellent game. From the same publisher as IK Plus as well, in System 3. We seem to have a lot of excellent games latterly in the 64 and early Amiga days. So I thought about that one. I thought about Leaderboard, actually, which I used to love.
Oh, yeah, Leaderboard was wonderful. Yeah, many an hour spent playing that.
I think I heard you talking about it a couple of weeks ago on one of the shows.
Yeah.
And I thought, it's amazing, because I did put it on. It's amazing how little golf games have changed in the last 30 years.
It is. It basically, the difference between that and Tiger Woods today is minute. I mean, it even had the bar, didn't it, that went up and down that you had to stop at the right point. Yeah.
I think it was the first one that used that, and then everybody else has copied that from leaderboard to links to Tiger Woods now. But for a simple golf game, which is going to act quite an accurate simulation, then yeah, people should have a look at that one. The only other thing I thought about putting it together wasn't the games I was going to talk about, but the fact that of the games that I chose as my three games, none of them came from Ocean Software, who I think were the largest publisher on 64 in those days. And probably because most of their stuff was movie tie-ins or coin-op conversions as well, which don't hold up in the same way that some of the other games do. Like the three I mentioned, like I saw Rats was going to talk about Drop Zone as well, which was an excellent game. These games like Robocop and Predator just don't hold up anymore.
No, and Cobra. I was playing Cobra the other day. I've forgotten just how awful it was.
But no, yeah, they had some shockers, didn't they?
They did, yeah, you're right. I think we did have two in the final list. We had The Great Escape and Head Over Heels, which they weren't really traditional ocean fodder. You know, they weren't, like you said, they weren't cheap conversions or movie tie-ins. I mean, Ocean were kind of like the Activision or the EA of their day, weren't they?
Yeah, they just picked up everything. And I was surprised, and I was reading about them on Wikipedia, that they were bought by Infogrames, who then obviously became Atari Europe, who then disappeared. So even though Ocean's name disappeared in the late 90s, the company still went on. I mean, a lot of the other publishers at the time faded away to nothing, like US Gold. And I think US Gold eventually went bankrupt at some point.
I think EA bought the rights to the US Gold in the end, but yeah, I think that you think you're right, they went bankrupt. Yeah, and we were talking mentioned Houston as well. That's another one that's just disappeared off the face of the earth.
Yeah,
Gremlin Graphics as well. Yeah, there was some good publishers back then. I think they became IDOS. I've got a funny feeling they were.
Yeah, I think they did. Didn't they? Yeah. I saw the Strident's list with Head Over Heels and the Spectrum, which I was never a Specky fan. I have to admit that. I was always the Commodore 64 side of the argument at school. But Head Over Heels was a fantastic game. I played it around at my friend's house lots, going there after school and trying to work out the puzzles. And between that and Batman as well.
Yeah.
In a similar style on Spectrum.
Yeah.
Just excellent, innovative games for the time. Just as good as the Sentinel was in building 3D. It invented the isometric style that we see today, I think.
They did, and I think in many ways those games also kind of pioneered the kind of puzzle aspect of sort of adventure games that you I'm trying to think that you see in things like things like Explosion Man. You know, the most recent sort of Xbox Live Arcade game has got elements in that were you can trace back to that period and to Head Over Heels with the flying, which was hard. Okay, so excellent. So just to recap, so Impossible Mission is available on the Virtual Console. 500 points. IK Plus, which, as you said, you're playing it every week virtually, which is a great game, also available on the Virtual Console. I guess 500 points again.
It is 500 points, yeah. So okay. 3.50 is a great buy.
And the Sentinel, I think there is a version on Lemon 64, and obviously there is a version on World of Spectrum as well, so there's two different versions there we can try. That's pretty much it. So thank you for your gaming suggestions. Once again, apologies to yourself and to the audience for the Skype cock-up, but as you said, these things happen. Are there any plugs or shout-outs you'd like to mention just before we move on?
No, just really to say thanks to you, Zan, for bringing this up as a topic. I think it's been a good topic to have for the replay show. There's a lot of us old fuddy-duddies out there
who
remember this stuff. So, I was looking forward to this coming up.
It'll be interesting to see what younger listeners and younger TGS community members make of some of these old games. I'll be quite interested in the feedback. So,
Well, I'm sure they should go out and try some of them.
Definitely.
Things were always better back in the day, after all.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that just brings us on, really, just to close the show, really, to talk about what games didn't make our lists. Obviously, if they didn't fit in the rules, or because the three games we picked to push them out of that shortlist. So let's start with yourself, Ratso. So are there any sort of notable games that you wanted to be in the list but didn't quite make it?
I have an enormous fondness for a game called Alley Cat, and it's not to be confused with the Alley Cat with a K by Andrew Braybrook for the Commodore 64, which hasn't aged at all well, to be honest. This is by a guy called Bill Williams, who's sadly no longer with us. He died about 10 years ago from cystic fibrosis. He went on to... He made a really interesting sort of piece of art for the 16-bits called Knights of the Crystallion, which was received with sort of gasps of awe and massive confusion in the late 80s or early 90s. But Alley Cat is just a... It was on PC first, I think, IBM PC when it was all cyan and purple graphics, the like four colours or whatever, got converted to the Atari 8-bit. You played a little cat, and you used to have to... It was divided into mini games. You used to have to clank up the dustbins and avoid things being thrown at you. And then there were all these different rooms to this house where you would end up warping through cheese, which makes no sense, swimming in a TARDIS-like fishbowl, avoiding a broom and dogs and leaving footprints on the floor, knocking things off shelves, and eventually trying to get amorous with a lady... a female feline past her jealous protective brothers, because that's the way things are in the world of cats. And it's just absolutely packed with charm, amazing music that I can still hum in my head to myself to this day. To be honest, I don't know that it's anyone's protecting the rights to emulate it. I think it's just that it's just completely been forgotten. So I don't know. Obviously, Bill Williams is no longer with us. Synapse Software, I don't think, exists in any sense. So maybe you could play it. I don't honestly know, but certainly I wasn't sure I could include it, so I didn't.
Okay. Strident, is there any notable ones that you'd like to mention?
Well, I possibly could have included any of the Ultimate games, particularly Saberwolf, I think, but obviously they're not available for legal emulation. I think one of the ones I particularly just missed out on my list was a game called Frankie Goes to Hollywood, which was actually based on the music of the band Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Oh, yeah. Which was a completely mad arcade adventure, totally off the wall, because it was one of these just random things all put together, very, very surreal. You were wandering around this sort of strange recreation of Liverpool, trying to solve a murder, but in doing so you were trying to get to the Pleasure Dome and become a complete person, and there was cryptic clues to solve a murder. As you wander into houses, you play mini games that were based on things like Breakout, and I think there was Gorbachev and Margaret Thatcher fighting each other at some point. It's a completely bizarre game, but you know, a decent game in itself, despite what it was actually based on. Totally, totally weird. I think that one was by Denton Designs as well, which I quite liked the work that they put out. But it was a very, very bizarre one. I recommend trying it, but I don't think you complete it either. I think it was one of these games that had a bug that made it quite difficult to complete. But yeah, I spent a lot of time playing that one.
Okay, thank you. And the one that I was going to make, I've actually already mentioned it, and that was Target Renegade. Which was really the first really good beat 'em up on the Spectrum, Commodore 64, Amstrad platform. And while you were talking there, I just opened the Wikipedia page just to check that I had my facts right, and I didn't, as usual. It did also come out on the SNES, on the NES rather, which I didn't know, and it was actually not based on a real live arcade game. It was, as if you've played it, a complete rip off of Double Dragon, but a much, much better game than Double Dragon, in my opinion. And it didn't make my list, really, because I felt that the three I picked were the ones that really represented that era for me. But certainly, if you like beat-em-ups, nothing wrong with Target Renegade, and you can, again, get that through legal emulation. Okay, I think that's probably everything. So, just to remind you, that will put links up to all of the games featured, either on the blog or on the forum. And what we would love to find out is what you think of these games. So we'd like you to try and get hold of them, to download and play them. Tell us what you think. Particularly interested in people who you know, maybe weren't even born during this period, to see what they think of some of these old games and whether they can, you know, they can actually see why we wax lyrical and why we're so fond of them. If you'd like to be a guest on the next edition of Replay, just to remind you, it's the BioShock podcast. If you send an email to feedback@thegamerscene.com, please use the subject Replay, or you can send a DM tweet or a PM to myself or to Ditz. If you want to be on the podcast, all you need is either Skype on your preferred operating system of choice, or just a BT landline, because I can actually just call you and conference you into the podcast when we record it. If you have any suggestions for future editions of Replay, either the regular Replay show or another special edition, I think we might secretly be planning to do a 16-bit one in a few months' time, then do leave your ideas on the forum, or again, you can use Twitter and use the tag TGS Replay, and then we'll be able to find it. So it just leaves me to really thank my guests and to give them an opportunity really to give any shout outs and to any plugs or last words. So start off with yourself, Ratso.
Oh, well, thanks very much for having me. It's been fantastic, great fun, lovely nostalging. You can hear my podcast with my erstwhile big Scottish I was going to say lover, but that's just that's what the iTunes reviews. That's what the iTunes reviews have started to suggest. He wishes. You can find us at gamerdork.net. There's no www. It's just http://gamerdork.net. If you want to come straight to the forum, just add a /// and the word forum at the end. If you just want to go to iTunes, just search for Gamerdork UK. That's it.
Lovely, thank you, and Striden.
Well, I think we've already given a shout-out to worldofspectrum.org, so I'm going to do a retro shout-out and shout out some people that I would have shouted out back in the day. So they won't be listening to the podcast, but I'm going to shout them out anyway. So I'd like to shout out adventure writer Erasure Fan, and I believe now stand-up comic Scott Denyer, John Wilson at Zenobi Software, real ale-drinking Sam Coupe fan Phil Glover, Barbara Gibbs, Sharon Hardwood, Mike Gerard, and Tim Kemp.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for that. I don't know if either of you guys read Retro Gamer, the magazine, but...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, big fan of that magazine. They do have retro events, don't they, every couple of months, and I am really tempted to go to the next one. This has really whetted my appetite again.
So, could be a plan, couldn't it?
It could be a plan indeed, yeah. I've actually got the latest copy downstairs to read now, so I might have a little read later and see when the next one is. For myself, I'd just like to thank Striden and Ratso for coming on the show. And finally, just a shout out to the Gamer Scene's Fly and Ditz for all the hard work they've done in actually getting the Gamer Scene launched. That's it. So just thank you, my guests, and I hope you'll join us at the end of the month for the BioShock edition of Replay. But until then, remember to play and join in, and I'll hope you join us next month.
Music. We play house music.
Electronic. download the future.